You know, a lot of churches, I think, and Christians avoid the topic of creation just because there's not uniform agreement about all the issues. So let me start, for those of you who don't know me, tell you a little bit about my background, education, why I'm teaching this course, and a little bit about my spiritual journey. For some reason, I've been interested in the origin of life and the universe since I was a child. I was interested in reading things, and I ended up being a science major as an undergrad. I majored in biology, took a lot of chemistry, some physics. And I went to graduate school. I was interested in medicine, but my skills were in administration, and so I studied. I got a master's in health administration. And I was a hospital administrator at UAMS for 12 years, worked with lots of scientists, chemists, not just physicians. And then I was CEO of Cartide there for 27 years and worked with a lot of people like physicists. And, you know, so I've kind of been in touch with the scientific fields my whole life, even though I didn't go advance in science. And I've continued to read and study origins in the Bible. I took two courses at a Bible college, one on creation in the Bible and one on science in the Bible. I've got a small bookshelf of books on the subject. I've taught creation in Bible studies and at other churches. And I haven't taught really at St. Andrew's at all. I've been studying and life gets in the way, mainly work with me. But and distractions, I have to say. But I retired 3 years ago and started writing a book that I felt like I needed to write about the Bible. And I decided to start with a section on creation, thinking it'd be easy, you know, and it would get me into the book. But the interesting thing is I actually didn't pull out my previous lectures and notes and books. I'll explain why. I know a lot of that stuff, but I'm not teaching the way I've taught it before. And so since I'm writing the book, I actually prayed for an opportunity to teach it. Your feedback and questions as we go along will be great for me. It'll help me write something that people can relate to. And I'm currently listening to a series of lectures from two master's level classes, one on the theology of Genesis and the theology of the Old Testament, and reading a bunch of theology books. So hopefully that'll inform a lot of our classes. So let me tell you just a little bit about my spiritual journey, particularly two events of it that I'd like to bring to you. I became a believer as a very young child. There's a lot of benefits to that. I don't know how old I was. I was too young. I was probably 4 to maybe 6, something of that age, and next month I'll be 67 years old, so that's a long period of time. So in that time, you know, I probably heard hundreds of sermons in Sunday school classes. I know thousands, actually. I know I've read hundreds of Christian books and done dozens of Bible studies, and all of those helped my spiritual walk, but there were really two events that enabled me to read the Bible for myself, and one of those was here at St. Andrew's, but the other one happened in my early 20s when I went to graduate school, and those two events are what I really think will supercharge your ability to read and understand, particularly the Old Testament, for yourself. As I said, I went to graduate school in my early 20s, and had my first serious crisis of faith, which, you know, happens to a lot of people in college. I was in grad school. What it was is that I really doubted whether Jesus was God. So that's kind of a big one. And as you might guess from my background, I'm just very interested in truth. And I needed proof that Christianity was true. And looking back, I can see why I had that crisis in my faith. You know, we either have to learn by education or experience. Samson had to learn by experience, for example. I'm principally a person who's learned by education, particularly, you know, because I've been a Christian for so long and in the Bible. But there's one area that I've had to learn by experience, and I've kind of done this experiment more than once, and it's never ended well. And basically, it goes back to something Jesus said in the temptation in the wilderness. When he'd not eaten 40 days and 40 nights, the devil came to him, offered him food, and he said, if you remember, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Well, that sounds pretty nice. It's been really real to me in my life. Every time I've gotten away from reading the Bible, hearing the word of God in church, my faith gets weak, my spirit gets weak, just as my physical body would if I didn't eat any food. So to me, that's a very practical statement. And I was in grad school out of state, no Bible, no church, extremely busy taking graduate level business courses in an MBA program with no undergraduate business at all. So I really didn't have time for a faith crisis. But, you know, when I had this realization, what I prayed for is truth. I was willing to leave Christianity if it wasn't true. And the thought that came to me, which I now know was God, was, you know, you really can't consider that you're educated if you've never read the best selling book of all time and you've never read the most quoted book of all time. And so that led me to have a desire to read the Bible. Now, if you listen to that thought, that was my pride, right? God used my pride to help me see that it was all true and bring me back into the faith. So that I actually did believe that the Bible was inspired, particularly the Old Testament, mainly because of how accurately it spoke of nature thousands of years before we knew the facts about the universe and fulfilled prophecy. So in grad school, I decided to read the Bible from cover to cover. And didn't have one, went to Target, found a little paperback version, looked at a lot of different versions, picked the one that, you know, I liked the way it sounded. And there are a lot of systems for reading the Bible from cover to cover. My system was to use a bookmark. You know, I started with the book, the Gospel of John, because that's what my childhood preacher has said. And then I read the rest of the New Testament. And, you know, I fell in love with Jesus. I wanted it to be true. I still wasn't convinced that it was true. It was really the Old Testament that convinced me that Jesus was God. Namely, the prophecies of who he would be and that the Messiah would be God. And some of these were prophecies I heard at Christmas all my life, and it never really registered. It ended well. But what I learned from that experience is I had a pencil, and that was probably my bookmark, actually. And as I was going through and I came to a verse I didn't understand, I didn't have a study Bible or commentaries or anything, I just put a question mark in the margin. And the interesting thing was, I not only read the Bible through once, I like to read. I not only read the Bible through once, when I read it through the second time, I couldn't for the life of me remember why that verse was confusing. And so what I really realized is just the how important it is to know what's communicated in other parts of the Bible, how much it clarifies other areas. And so, you know, you may not be a reader, you may not be reading it from cover to cover. I'm going to do a lot of that work for you with respect to creation. And, you know, when you're studying the Bible, if you had any science, you may have heard of inductive reasoning, What you want to do if you want to understand a subject is look at all the verses on that subject before you form an opinion. Well, if you've not read, I mean, there are 11 authors that write a lot about creation. You know, most of them like whole chapters about creation. And we don't study them. We don't know that information. And you don't want to form opinions before you've got all the facts. And so, you know, I like to cook. But I'm the kind of person who likes to take help from the grocery store, buy things already chopped and peeled. So that's the way I'm going to present this class, you know. I'll have already done the mining, and I'll present it to you. You know, as we talk about topic by topic, this is what Isaiah says, this is what Ezekiel says. There's some New Testament information about creation, too. And so we'll look at all those passages. There's no one chapter that gives you all the information about creation. And it starts simple and gets much more complex. So what the Apostle Paul says is pretty complex. But we'll start with more basic stuff to where, you know, we can understand that. So my second experience, as I said, was here at St. Andrew's. We had the Anglican School of Ministry. This was 10 years ago. I attended the school at night for several years, did all the Bible, biblical exegesis kind of classes, and I learned how to understand the narrative accounts and the poetry in the Old Testament, things that I've really not been exposed to before. And what I've realized, particularly now as I'm trying to be a writer, is just how extremely talented the Old Testament writers were. And they used definite techniques that occur again and again that communicate the meaning that the author wants to get across through the structure, not just the words. And so that's what I hadn't been exposed to before. And some of you may, I suspect a few of these you'll have heard before. Some of them will be new to you. And this style of writing has not been around since 500 BC. So it's not surprising that we're not familiar with the style. And it's pretty recently been rediscovered. I had to read in the school the book that really kind of started scholars think having an aha moment, and I think it was written in the 1980s, so relatively new. So I'm going to introduce that information kind of one at a time as a series of tools as we go through the biblical creation accounts. For example, just to kind of give you an idea of what these are, the biblical narrators use words very sparingly, which may seem not true since the Bible is so thick, but every word counts and nothing in the text is meaningless. Now, that's not the style we're used to in the Western world. I mean, even in ancient Greece and Rome, if you want to read some of the stories now and back then, you get all kinds of detail. I mean, if there's a character introduced, we learn how long their eyelashes and fingernails are, right? I mean, it's just how they dress, everything. If you go through the Old Testament in particular, there's almost no physical descriptions of anyone. I mean, you may have seen movies about the Book of Ruth. She's beautiful. There's absolutely no physical description of Ruth in the Book of Ruth. The only thing that is said about Ruth is she's young. And that's because the authors don't want to distract us from the meaning. It had nothing to do with what happened, had nothing to do with her physical appearance. So that's one of the tools, and we'll come back to that, and you'll begin to see it, I think, as we go along. And once you begin to understand this, and you know, I'm a science and business background person. If you're a literature person, this may be easier for you than it was for me. I'm going to make it easy doing it step by step, but I kind of had to study this. You may get it quicker than I will. There are also layers of meaning about God in the text, but it's very subtle and nuanced. So the writer of the Book of Ruth is one of the most talented writers of all of this, and He tells us things about God you don't find anywhere else in the Bible. Well, you know, how many women's retreats have you gone to that taught the book of Ruth? Do they make it all about God? You know, I mean, there's meaning there that, and hope, and so I'm excited that you're going to be able to begin to see those things for themselves. So you're going to put on some new lenses and begin to read the Bible differently than they had before, because you're going to begin to look for how it's put together. And when you see how it's structured, it helps you read differently. As one person said, we must first know how a text means before we can know what it means. So, and we'll begin to zero in on these tools probably in a couple of weeks and do one or two a week. So you can get it, see it, and start using it yourself. Now, when I started, as I said, when I started to write my book about the Bible and write about creation, I made the decision to start fresh and use the tools that I'm going to introduce to you. So I tried to let the Bible speak to me about what it wanted me to hear. And, you know, rather than search for what I wanted to find in it, which, frankly, I think we all do at times. And it was very apparent early on that the creation accounts are really all about God. And they're written to answer who God is and why we and anything exists. Things that we can never answer for ourselves through science, through our own efforts. And they're what we most need to know. So, you know, why are we here? Is there meaning and purpose in life? What's God like? Is God going to come alongside me in this, you know, circumstance? So most of my studies and books ended up trying to answer when and how, and focusing on that. Those are the kind of controversial aspects of creation. And what I realized is, in all of my previous studies, a lot of what we learn about creation, we're majoring on the minors. And so we're in this class going to try and major on the majors, which is who God is and why we're here. Now, it does say, it does speak to when and how and so forth, and we will look at those. They give us evidence that what we can't verify, the who and the why, are true, because we can see that they're true. But they're not the main points. So, and some of the puzzling questions I put in the little blurb really are puzzling to us because we don't really understand all the information about God given in these creation accounts. I really want to talk about, I'll talk about three issues today. And first is, it's why is it so important to have a biblical worldview of origins, both for ancient Israel and for us. And, you know, let's also talk about, are the creation accounts myths, which you hear people say, and are they scientific? As, you know, some of y'all said, you want to get into. But let's start with why it's important to study. And it's not just about curiosity or even being able to witness to other people who may have doubts because of what they heard the Bible says about creation. I notice when I talk to those people, they've not actually read the Bible for themselves. They've heard what the Bible says and don't actually question it. They don't do what I did and go and read it. So you'll hear a lot of things about what the Bible says. You want to come away from this class kind of knowing, okay, this is what the Bible says, and these are assumptions. If you're human, they may or may not. They don't certainly don't have the same value as the revelation from the Bible. So, you know, it's really about knowing God. And Calvin said, you cannot know yourself unless you know God. It's also important for us as the people of God to have a biblical worldview or view of reality, and that starts with your view of origins. So, on your handout, we'll talk about two things. Why was it important for ancient Israel, the original audience that, you know, Moses and the other authors were speaking to, which always will help you kind of understand a passage if you know what its purpose is, why it's written. Israel's situation, when Moses chose to start the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, with a creation account, is they were 12 tribes that were wandering in the desert and wondering what in the world God was doing, right? They were rebelling, and they needed to know that they had a purpose and a destiny to conquer the promised land. So, and they needed, and to have the courage to do that, they needed to know what God is like. So they had to understand a God who's holy, which is a totally unique idea at that time in human history. No God was holy. And so Moses writes the Pentateuch basically to tell them that they're an integral part of what the creator of the world is trying to accomplish. And that, so it gives them a message of hope, and it's written to us as a message of hope as well. Now, what I really didn't realize is that in Egypt, the 12 tribes had practiced pagan worship. And I've got the two verses there. They were deep into paganism. They had not maintained the faith of Abraham as they spent 430 years in Egypt. So, and the pagan cultures around them in Egypt and in Canaan had stories about the origin that all had to do with, say, a war in heaven, and one god got mad at another and they chopped each other up and made matter out of somebody's body parts, or one god raped another god, or the earth was created by some god being spit out after they'd been murdered. Matter had a very bad connotation and a bad beginning when that's the reality of every human being. I mean, we've got to realize that. We think the way we view the world is makes sense and it's just there, huh? It's there because of the Bible. It's totally, radically different thinking. And I'll talk some more about that. And they also thought that the gods were just powerful people who acted really badly. And they had control over some aspect of creation. And human beings were not created in their image. They were created to be servants and feed the gods. That was all men were good for. Very, you can see how radically different. Okay, so that's the context of Genesis 1. That's what, and we need to understand what Moses is trying to accomplish to see it through the lens of the person who wrote it and his audience. You know, they would have understood the Genesis 1, the creation accounts are a contrast to Egyptian mythology and Canaanite mythology. God had to give them truth before he could use them in his plan, and it was very different truth. You remember his first commandment is there'll be no other gods before me. You know, there's no other authority but God. And in their history, you know, once they're in the promised land, they repeatedly fell into pagan worship. And so different biblical writers had to keep bringing them back to creation and origin, had to be reminded over and over. And after the exile, they may not have had nature deities. That kind of got out of their system in Babylon. But, you know, they replaced them with things that give a person, you know, security and significance and so forth. So ancient Israel needed spiritual freedom as well as physical freedom from the bondage of slavery, because they were worshiping pagan gods. And Moses begins their education with the origin of the earth to tell them about God. Okay, so why is it important to us? And if you'd look at the little triangle on there, a lot of people talk about where does our view of reality come from, and where do our behaviors and our values come from. The basis of culture is what you believe. And it begins with what you believe about where you came from. Worldview, if you're not familiar with that term, is how you make sense of reality and how you make sense of the world. Just think of your worldview as a pair of glasses. And everything passes through your worldview lens. And, you know, like any glasses, you have to clean them up. They can get steamed up. You have to have them with you all the time. It's how you will view life's challenges and what's real. And so Genesis 1 and other passages set the worldview for the community of faith. We're to be a pure people. We're to have a different value system. Just think about what the Christian community thinks about origins and our view of the world. You know, there is a God responsible for the universe being here. There's a reality beyond the physical universe. The physical universe is real, and God has given us the capacity to investigate that world, to use our senses to observe nature. But that's not the only way of knowing, just by using our senses. Our ethics and values are moral principles that came from this same Creator who created the universe, and they're true for all people. They're not just something you discover. An atheist would say that people invent ethics. Our ultimate value is God, having a relationship with God. And if you look at the little triangle, it goes upward. Our values lead to institutions such as the church or educational institutions or Sunday schools that teach about the biblical worldview and biblical values, and institutions that have respect for human life and human rights. All of that comes out of our worldview. And, you know, life in... like the 12 tribes, we are also saved out of an ungodly worldview when we accepted Christ. And we still live in a world governed by an ungodly worldview. So we need correct information from the Bible. You know, we're saved out of a worldview that man is autonomous, can do anything he wants to achieve, and we're brought into a worldview that man is a creature dependent on the Creator. We're saved out of a secular system that believes that even if creation was started by God, he's irrelevant because he doesn't intervene today. These are the myths that we're living with today. Our Western culture is actually shifting back to a worldview that Israel was saved out of. And each age has to confront a different myth regarding origins that informs a worldview. So a lot of worldviews we're confronting today would be things like materialism, humanism, secularism. So it's important for us to have a biblical worldview to live the Christian life. So we don't want any missing bricks in our origins foundation, right? So let's see how this might look with different ideas about creation. If there's no creator and everything is just random accidental events, then there's no ultimate meaning or purpose and no value in human life. You might want to grasp matter and get all you can. So what you may value would be power. Or you might value humanity and think, if we can just all get together, there's nothing we couldn't accomplish. And if you think about where you've heard that before, it's the Tower of Babel, right? Or you might think any belief system is just as valid as any other, and everybody can believe or worship whatever they want because there's no such thing as truth. Well, early Christianity lived in that world. Ancient Rome had many gods over each geographic area. So, you know, it is relevant to us today. And it's also important because nature declares God's glory. And you can see Psalm 19 there tells us that what can be seen in the sky provides evidence of God's glory to all mankind. And that revelation began at creation. The Apostle Paul echoes this thought that God has disclosed himself in nature and what he did at creation. He's actively showing himself to the world. And yet the world is in rebellion against him. They actually have to deny what they can plainly see from nature. And Paul goes on to tell us that the loss of knowledge of God leads to the exchange of truth for a lie. So the result is not that you're smarter. It's that something created is served and worshipped instead of the Creator, and judgment's the result. And this is really a basic problem with humanity and rebellion against God. It seems to be our default tendency. I mean, love of self at its heart is loving the creature instead of the Creator, right? I mean, we're created. The biblical writers will tell us about God and their creation accounts in ways that will help us not fall into worshiping the creature instead of the creation. Okay, so let's talk for a minute about, is it a myth? You hear that a lot. That actually depends on how you define myth. It's actually not a precise word. If you mean it the way we normally use it to refer to a story that's fanciful and not true, then no, it's not a myth. But there are 12 definitions of the word myth, and one of them is close to the definition. If it's a story that explains phenomenon in man's experience, in that respect, you could say it's a myth. Actually, Genesis 1, as we'll see as we go through it, is a passionate argument against ancient myths. You know, scholars have noted that it actually mocks the myths of surrounding cultures, what humanity believed before this revelation. And it's so radically different and superior to every other creation account that there just doesn't seem to be an explanation for it other than supernatural revelation. And for example, in the face of religions that made gods out of the sun and the moon, Moses doesn't even give them names. They're just two big lamps up there, and they're part of creation. So in its context is an argument against that kind of thinking. For ancient Israel, also true for us. Every pagan culture thinks of every aspect of nature as a god, while the Bible speaks of nature as an it. Okay, so is it scientific? No, because the subject is God, not forces of nature, which is what all science looks at. And no, because it uses everyday speech instead of mathematics and technical language. Actually, science can't talk about what the Bible is interested in, ultimate purpose and meaning, having a relationship with God so that man can be wise for salvation. Science just talks about what it can observe within our universe, right? Now, Genesis 1 starts from the same place as some of these other myths, so it appears to be similar. That similarity is more apparent than real, and we'll talk about it. Why, for example, would Moses start Genesis 1 in the same place, which is when the earth was in a state of chaos? Well, that's what everybody believed, and God's given them all this radically new information, but he meets them where they are, within what they're comfortable with, what they know, within their culture, and then begins to give them the radically new information. So it actually, I think, is a really good thing about God. You can't find God with any of the instruments of science. You know, God is spirit. The instrument of spirit is faith or spiritual conviction. So trying to find God using science would be like trying to examine Jupiter looking through a microscope, right? It's just an inadequate instrument. And if you wanted a relationship, let's say you wanted a relationship with me, and you couldn't talk to me, you could just observe me like a scientist. I mean, you might come up with a lot of opinions about whether I needed to lose weight or, you know, whether I dressed funny or et cetera, but you'd never have a relationship with me. You'd never get to know me. The method is wrong for the search. So the Bible has a different purpose. And I think complaining that the Bible doesn't describe things using late 20th, 21st century scientific terminology is as silly as criticizing a calculus book because it doesn't tell you how to conjugate a Russian verb. I mean, it's not its purpose. Now, are science and the Bible at war with one another? Two books written in the 1800s with a political purpose had this idea. They were debunked, but some of that thought stayed in the popular consciousness. I took a course on the history of science, and the professor said, no serious historian of science or the science-religion issue today maintains the warfare hypothesis. Science actually had its roots in Christian Europe about four centuries ago and the biblical worldview. And actually, you know, people wondered, why was science stillborn in every other culture, advanced cultures? Why was it only born and stayed in Christian Europe? And we're coming near the end of our time, so I think I'll go into a little bit of detail about that at the first of the next session. But I want to kind of give you an idea of where we're going, how we're going to get there. In the next week or two, we're going to look at all the verses that tell us about the creation of the universe, the big picture. And these verses, I think, really tell us how different God is from how we are, and they're why we have all these puzzling questions. You know, it's really not that maybe you're not smart enough or you hadn't read enough or you don't know this or that. It's really that we're human and we're not God, and we have difficulty getting that. And the next week or two, we're really going to hone in on that. We're not going to go to Genesis 1 for a couple of weeks, and there are two reasons for that. One, it focuses on how God formed the earth for life and filled it with life. The earth is already in existence when it starts, so it doesn't tell us about the universe and stars and all of that. That's the other authors do that. And two, Genesis 1 is a really unique type of literature in the Bible. You know, if you want to understand poetry, there's lots of poetry. If you want to understand prophecy, there's lots of prophecy. There's no other book like Genesis 1, and I think you'll see why. So we're going to need those tools to really dig into it and understand it. So after we look at the universe, we'll begin focusing in on the two chronological, only two of the, all of the creation accounts are chronological. We from the Western world, very logical, chronological. There are only two that are chronological. It's Genesis 1 and Psalm 104. And so we'll kind of go through those in a chronological manner, and we'll look at all the related passages week by week until we get to the creation of Eve, right? The last thing created was Eve. And we'll also look at the Garden of Eden as what the life we were meant to live was like. But we'll stop before we get to the fall or the rebellion. And we don't have to, we can stop and talk if things are confusing. We'll just see how it goes. All right. Well, thank you all for coming. I hope it answered some of your questions. And those 3x5 cards, if there's something you really want to hear about, put them on the 3x5 card, leave them on the chair, give them to me, so I can kind of make sure we cover all of that.